Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And this is Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to another episode of Seriously. Of all the pop culture-y events that have been going on this week, I feel like the fact that the Harry Potter play script has been released has been the biggest one, don't you?
Absolutely. When we discussed you're going to see the play a few weeks ago, we did say that when the play text came out, we were going to talk in depth and in detail about it, and that day has now arrived.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're going to do. So if you haven't finished reading the play or are going to go see the play or don't want to be spoiled for this, like, step away now. Go as far away as you possibly can. We're going hard. We're going in depth. We're going absolutely spoiler full down to the last detail.
This is for Harry Potter fans who have already read or seen The Cursed Child or don't care that they're about to find out exactly what happens in it. Because, and that leads me quite seamlessly on to my first point, which is that I didn't like this play.
Yeah, that's probably something we should say from the outset, is that we were perhaps not the biggest fans
of this script.
But for those who don't know and are choosing to listen anyway, Harry Potter and the Cursed Child is a play in two parts by J.K. Rowling, John Tiffany and Jack Thorne, following on from the Harry Potter series. Advertising itself as the eighth story, the script went on sale on Sunday so that Harry Potter fans worldwide who can't make the sold-out show in London can read the new work for themselves. The general plot is basically as follows. Harry and Ginny's son, Albus Severus Potter,
who we met very briefly in the epilogue to the seventh book.
Yeah, he's going off to school along with Hermione and Ron's daughter Rose Granger Weasley and Draco Malfoy's son Scorpius, all of whom we glimpsed in the epilogue. Albus and Scorpius are both quite unpopular at school and they become best friends as a result.
Oh, and as set up in the epilogue, Albus bucks the trend of his family and gets sorted into Slytherin rather than Gryffindor.
Yeah.
Hence why he and Scorpius are best buddies.
So Albus and Severus meet Cedric Diggory's cousin, Delphi Diggory, who persuades them to go back in time using a time turner to save her cousin, who died in the Triwizard Tournament in the fourth book. Fans of the series will remember.
And that event was part of the advent of the return of Voldemort that then played out over the next three books.
Yeah, they accept this challenge, and every time they go back, Albus and Scorpius basically end up altering the future, messing everything up, and they end up bringing back Voldemort. Once they fix that mess, Delphi Diggory reveals herself as not actually Cedric's cousin at all, but actually the daughter of Voldemort and Bellatrix Lestrange. And then she takes Albus and Scorpius back in time again to the night of Harry's parents' death, where she hopes to stop Voldemort from killing Harry and thereby ensure his rise to power. Then, using some weird trick with a blanket, they alert Harry, Ron, Hermione, Ginny and Draco, who all go back in time to stop her.
Using a second time turner.
Yeah.
That just happens to pop up.
Yeah, that's basically the whole story.
Yeah, that's the story. And as you can tell from the tone of our voices, we had lots of problems with it.
My immediate bias here, I hate time travel. I hate time travel and stuff. I didn't particularly enjoy the time travel in Prisoner of Azkaban, although it was dealt with in a completely different way to this play and was much better as a result, I think. But yeah, time travel, it's so complicated and it raises so many more questions than it answers, and yeah. It just seems like a weird choice for this play.
I don't hate it quite as much as you do. I have liked various Doctor Who things in the past and stuff, but I like it with a caveat, which is it has to obey its own rules. Not only does this contradict J.K. Rowling's previous dabble into time travel, which she herself has said that she didn't like very much.
Yeah, I've got that quote here. She says, "I went far too lightheartedly into the subject of time travel in Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. While I don't regret it, it opened up a vast number of problems for me, because after all, if wizards could go back and undo their problems, where were my future plots? I solved the problem to my own satisfaction in stages." And then she explains how she basically had Dumbledore and Hermione be like, time travel's really dangerous. She had Hermione give back the time turner to Hogwarts, and then she destroyed all in the Department of Mysteries during that battle there. And she says, "This is just one example of the ways in which, when writing fantasy novels, one must be careful what one invents. For every benefit, there is usually a drawback." And none of that stuff was really resolved in this play. Yeah. It just all became more complicated.
I feel like she contradicted her own advice there by not only, on a slightly thin premise, bringing back this idea of the time turner as a device, she also changed what it could do, because the time turner that Hermione has in The Prisoner of Azkaban, she has to turn it a set number of times, and you can just redo immediately preceding hours, can't you? So you turn it 3 times to go back 3 hours, then you do those 3 hours again. So you can't jump decades back in time.
There are some like attempts by the writers here to be like, oh, this one looks different to the other one.
Yeah,
and
but
like,
that's so crass.
This one seems a bit broken and stuff, but we've had no indication before that there would be lots of different ways of travelling through time.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
It's just not very convincing to be like, oh, but a couple survived. There's not even one that survives in this play. There's like two.
There's two, yeah.
It seems like everyone actually has one knocking around somewhere. So it feels a little bit like a cheat, perhaps, to be like, oh, you thought they were all gone. You were wrong, lol.
Yes, exactly. One thing I will say that I did quite like about the story was its focus on Cedric Diggory. Mm-hmm. As a pivotal point in the story. I did think that was really good, because although in the books, emotionally, it carries significance for Harry 2-3 books later, he's still thinking about the fact that, you know, Cedric, who was completely uninvolved in any of this, just died as the spare. I feel like maybe it doesn't get given so much emphasis by the likes of Dumbledore and stuff for being so pivotal.
And as more characters die,
it fades.
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah. Whereas I thought the fact that it was identified by both good and bad sides
as a
in
really
this
key.
Play as the crux of everything. That was good. That
it's
was
certainly tonally as well, yeah. For the books, the point where everything becomes a lot darker. Suddenly people can die.
Yes, and people who aren't really fighting, just innocent bystanders.
That relates, I think, to a bit of the plot that I didn't like. So I agree with you that Cedric dying is actually a huge deal for the series, and it's powerful because it's just this one innocent person who gets slain out of nowhere. I thought it was really a crazy choice to go back to the night where Harry's parents died.
Yes, I agree.
So they time travel back to that night at basically the climax of the whole play. And I found that just to be such a weird choice, because the power of that night comes from the fact that, although obviously it was not that ordinary a night because Voldemort was rising to power, in the context of Voldemort's rise, it's a pretty average night. He's killing some people, as he has been doing every night for months. There's nothing about them that should be special, but the power of love changed that night and made it interesting, and that's the only exceptional part of that entire evening. When you've got like 5 people from the future fighting the daughter of Voldemort, suddenly the whole thing is really, really complicated and this like extraordinary spectacle, and it changes, for me, what makes that moment in the book so significant and what makes it resonate decades later, which was sad for me.
Yeah, I agree. That night was kind of sacred in Harry's mind, and I think in generally, because it becomes so part of the mythology of the wizarding world, and yeah, they just ripped it up in a way that was frustrating.
I would have really liked if this had been centered more in Hogwarts in the time,
yes, absolutely,
of the original. If it had just been about Albus and Scorpius just trying to make their way in school, having problems with other students, learning a bit of magic, maybe finding something weird and dark and threatening that wasn't actually to do with Voldemort in the school, that's the kind of sequel I would have liked. Something that was structurally a lot more similar to a Harry Potter book, something that maybe followed these characters in detail with their peers. I didn't feel like it was necessary to keep raking over events that we already knew and loved.
You can move it on. There were lots of areas where they could have done something new in the same world, but instead they just rehashed the same stuff, but from a different angle.
It was, and undermined what we thought we knew about it.
Yeah, and this, I think the same can be said of the treatment of some of the characters, actually. So the characters we know from the book, and the ones we know particularly well, i.e. Harry, Ron, Hermione, Ginny, are in some ways kind of undermined by their portrayal in this play.
Yeah, which did you have particular problems with?
Ron.
Yes.
Was the worst one. So Ron in the books is this quick to temper, insecure, quite volatile, blunt character who then in the seventh book, you know, he's wearing the Horcrux for a lot of the time that they're on the run from Voldemort. He's affected worse by it than Harry or Hermione, eventually leads to him sort of abandoning them and then coming back. And his coming back is a really crucial plot point. So Ron has depth, is what I'm trying to say,
yeah,
in the books. Play Ron does not have depth. Play Ron is like your dad's divorced friend who he wishes he wasn't friends with, but out of pity is still friends with him.
Yeah, and like comes round with like some practical jokes for everyone.
He comes round with shit presents and is constantly making terrible jokes that his heart isn't really in them.
There's that line in the play where he says that he's really chilled out compared to everyone else, which just drove me crazy because I was like, have you met Ron? Like, no, he's not chilled
out
at all.
He's not chilled out about anything.
Harry and Hermione are a lot cooler in a crisis than Ron.
Yeah.
Incidentally, I thought that Harry and Hermione were strong. I thought
yeah,
they were well,
they were okay,
well adapted, well portrayed. There were some moments with both of them. There's this weird moment where they go back in time and Ron and Hermione have never got married, and Hermione is a teacher at Hogwarts and she's really, really bitter and really angry and really mean to everyone, and the implication is that because she didn't marry Ron, it like changed her and she became this like very bitter, twisted person, which I just think is like a quite anti-feminist, the idea that like Hermione's best parts are basically Ron, and just not true. Like, I think Hermione would have been absolutely fine without Ron. I think she loves Ron and, you know, she loves him as a husband rather than as a friend, but if she had ended up loving him as a friend, she would have been absolutely fine.
Yeah, there's a fic actually that I really like that addresses this, where it's set about 10, 12 years after the Battle of Hogwarts, and Hermione and Ron in that particular fictional universe date for a couple of years after Hogwarts and then break up. Mm-hmm. And Ron dates other people. Hermione stays single through most of her 20s. She's focusing on her career and she's fine.
Yeah.
They're both fine.
Exactly. So I thought that was unfair to Hermione, who is a very kind and loving person beyond her feelings, like romantically. I also thought Snape was a real down point. They bring Snape
I don't even
back.
Want to think about that. So when, you know, when Harry is really young, he's like 11 or 12, and Snape just seems like the worst thing that's ever happened to him because he's so authoritative and gloomy and scary.
Mm-hmm.
You'd expect play Snape to be like that.
Yeah, but worse, because he's living in his worst life.
He's living his worst nightmare and also having to pretend that he loves it.
Yeah, whereas this Snape is A, pretty chipper about everything, makes a lot of jokes.
Makes weird jokes.
See, it's like absolutely fine with some kid he's never known coming up to him and being like, you were in love with Lily. A, how does Scorpius even know that? Has he read the Harry Potter series? It seems like he has. So it doesn't seem like this is like a known fact in the Wizarding world. B, we saw all those scenes where like Harry would sneak and have a look at the pensieve and like Snape would absolutely lose his shit, and he had no reason to really, because Harry's on the side of good. Harry is a part of Lily in a way. Like, if any, I know he doesn't like Harry because of the James connection, but if anyone was really going to be the person he would admit this stuff
to, it would be Harry.
Probably be Harry, if not, you know, if it's not Dumbledore or somebody. He goes absolutely mental. Here comes some kid he's never even met, like pretending to be from the future. And he's like, you love Lily? And he's like, ah, you are right, child. It's like, really weird. So weird. And Cedric Diggory too gets completely raked over the coals, where he basically, because he is humiliated in the Triwizard Tournament, becomes a Death Eater and is responsible for helping Voldemort
Which
get to power.
Which is absolutely not the Cedric that we know from the books, who was irritatingly honourable, manipulated by a Death Eater because he was so honourable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because Barty Crouch knew that he'd help Harry if he himself had been helped, etc., etc., he set Cedric up
as
part of that plot, using, so that's how obvious his nobility was.
And even Voldemort as a character, I feel like, is completely like, in the dark world where Cedric and Snape are like living under Voldemort, everyone goes around saying, for Voldemort and valor. I really feel like valor is not a quality that Voldemort was pro. He was pretty pro, like, fear and, like, extreme subservience to authority, which is the opposite of valor, right?
Yeah, he really liked confusion, chaos, terror. He did not like showy acts of bravery.
People are like, doing this weird thing with their wrists. Yeah, and he also has a child, which I just think is fundamentally something Voldemort would not do.
Yeah, again, that's something that the idea that the Death Eaters were part of a kind of rape circle is something that comes up in fic sometimes. I don't like reading it. I feel like this is the worst possible extension of that.
Yeah, because the idea is almost like that Voldemort and Bellatrix were a couple, which is convincing from the Bellatrix character.
Yeah, because she loves him. She seems... But in like a weird, as you say, subservient way.
Yeah, but not... I mean, Voldemort, A, just can't experience love, so he wouldn't do it for that reason. He has no need for an heir because he thinks he's going to live forever. And he just doesn't seem interested in sex at all. So, no. I mean, I know he's interested in power. So that's the only way you could see it is if he, like, as you say, maybe raped her. But it just all seems a bit wrong, doesn't it? It just doesn't sit with me quite
right. It seems like both having sex and having a child would be part of the humanness that Voldemort was so keen to leave behind. Mm-hmm. That he thought he could rise above that.
Yeah.
All human functions like love and presumably going to the toilet and stuff. Yeah. He didn't think he had to do. But just on the flip side though, I can see that is the kind of rumour that might get traction in a post-Voldemort society.
Definitely.
That, oh god, Voldemort had a secret love child, she's going to kill us all, is the kind of thing the Daily Prophet would probably run.
And a really Harry Potter style thing to have done would have been at the end of this play to reveal that actually she wasn't Voldemort's child, she was just a bit deluded.
Yes, exactly. She was just a kind of copycat crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, because then it would like dismiss the idea that evil is something that is inheritable.
Yeah.
Because it's just constantly portrayed as not in the books.
On the plus side, I am very pro Scorpius.
Same.
In this play.
I also think
really good.
The actor who plays him is so charismatic and like so great at the role. So it's worth seeing the play for Scorpius. Mm. He's really, really funny. And I think he sort of stands in as the like geeky Harry Potter fan at points.
Yes. He's very, as you say, he's almost too knowledgeable about what's going on. And
he's funny. He's just really funny. He gets all the best lines.
Yeah.
And he really carries the show with him, really just propels the play forward. So I think, yeah, he's a really, really well-written original character. And it just shows what you can do if you actually don't worry too much about obsessing over the original characters from the series. It was great to see some new characters like Scorpius who are actually really well fleshed out.
Which is a shame, actually, instantly, that we didn't get more of those characters who didn't have a backstory like Rose, for instance. It would have been fun if she was in it a bit more. And maybe James and Lily, Albus's brother and sister, mm-hmm. like we barely see
Hugo.
Them. Hugo, Rose's little brother.
It would have been nice to see a few different, so you know, I would have liked to see all of those characters.
I agree with you. If it was like the next generation goes to Hogwarts type play, then they would have all have been more in it and that would have been fun to see how they developed. Yeah, so because I haven't seen the play, you have. Were there any other things that either made more sense now you've read the play text or less sense?
I don't think there was anything that made more sense in reading the text. I think there are some things in the text which are a better experience when you watch the play. For example, there's this bit in the text where it says, oh, you see that there are like scribbles all over the wall about like this prophecy.
Oh yeah, in Delphi's weird lair.
So that is like all over the stage, but also the entire theatre, on all the walls, on all the floor, and they reveal it by using some UV light. So you've been sat in this theatre for hours and hours, maybe 2 days if you've gone and come back, and you've not had any hint of it, and then these UV lights comes on in there. That it's like, you know, all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy in The Shining. It's just absolutely everywhere, and it's crazy. That's really cool. A lot of the performances are really, really good. So Jamie Parker as Harry is brilliant. The actors who play Hermione and Harry are both really, really brilliant, and all the scenes sort of in the Ministry, I could just watch again and again. I thought those were great. As I say, the guy who played Scorpius was brilliant, and a lot of the special effects are really something, like the Dementors, really, really something.
How do they do the time turner bits?
Oh, the time turner bit is really clever. So as they spin the time turner, as they do in the film, you hear this ticking. There's a lot of ticking noises used very well in the play. And then there's this sort of big wobbly light, and I don't know how they do it, but this big ripple of light basically goes across the entire stage, and it makes it look like you're looking at water, and everything in the water is like having these big ripples going out from the center, which is where the time turner is. And it's really convincing. It makes you feel really like disoriented. So yeah, those sorts of effects, like I couldn't even find a bad thing to say about them if I really, really tried. They were perfect. So there are lots of things that are better about the play in the flesh, as I'm sure you can expect. And also I think it's less jarring to hear people talk about their feelings on stage. So
yeah, because you have to have that kind of not entirely realistic.
Yeah, stuff that you wouldn't do in a film or in a book, where people say things like, I loved you, you know, which is just not something that you know, happens in a Harry Potter book, but does happen in this play. So I guess you have to understand that that's a generic.
Did it jar with you when you saw the play performed, how Draco talks? Because it really jarred with me written down. The way he constantly calls Harry by his full name.
Yeah, he's a bit like, and actually this is a point I would say in general, if you've seen the Very Potter musicals, which I would highly recommend, the third Very Potter musical, which is, you know, a musical, is extremely silly, is not meant to be taken seriously, has a plot very similar to this play. Extremely similar. The Malfoy character in a Very Potter musical is played by this little girl, and she does a lot of, "Harry Potter, back to ruin my day!" And she does this really overblown, hammy performance, and that's sort of what the Draco in this play is like, except then sometimes he's also like, "I love Hermione!" Like, he doesn't make sense. No. He's very like the Very Potter musical character who's obsessed with Hermione. So yeah, I would actually recommend watching a Very Potter musical if you were disappointed by this play, because it's so great, starring Darren Criss from Glee. But yeah, so I think on the whole, we were disappointed, right?
We were, and I do think that if you have just listened to all of that and were still thinking about maybe reading the play, I wouldn't bother. Just don't put yourself through it. Maybe go and see it and enjoy it as Anna says, like a really cool special effects spectacle. But I know J.K. Rowling is in charge of the canon. She made it up. And she says this is canon. And so fine, it's her canon. But I think you are completely at liberty to just disregard it. You really don't have to incorporate it into your imaginary world.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The next thing we're going to talk about this week is the David Bowie prom, which we went to last Friday.
Yay.
It's part of the prom series at the Albert Hall, which is a classical music festival that runs for, I think, about 3 months with different concerts every single night. This one featured the Stargaze Orchestra and vocalists, including Amanda Palmer, Neil Hannon, Lauren Vuller, and Anna Calvi. It was billed as a celebration kind of inspired by the wide variety of David Bowie's music, not specifically a tribute concert.
Mm-hmm.
which I think is quite important in the way that you appreciated it. Because we had a great time.
We had a great time. I have to thank Caroline for taking me, because it was just, I've never been to the proms before, and I've certainly never been to an evening like that before, which I think probably a lot of proms people hadn't either. It was very, very strange, very unusual. And for that, I thought it was perfect. We had a great time.
Yeah, we had a really great time. But reading the reviews of other critics afterwards, we were kind of in the minority.
Yeah, I read a lot of very sarcastic tweets from, because this was broadcast on TV.
It was broadcast live on TV and the radio, I think.
Yeah, yeah. So it was on BBC 4 and BBC Radio 6, I think, maybe.
I think, yeah.
So a lot of people were not in the concert, but watching along, and people were really, like, horrified and making jokes, like, during Space Oddity, oh, I think they should do Space Oddity next. And, the general vibe was like, why have you taken these really, really great songs and turned them into completely different songs? I mean, that's what they did. They did alter them, but for me, that's the point.
I don't feel like they were ever pretending they were doing anything else. Even I remember going to the press conference when they announced the programme for the proms, which normally happens in about May every year, and then it actually starts in July. And when they were talking about the David Bowie prom, they were like, yeah, we're really, really pleased to be able to have squeezed it into the schedule, but we're not doing a like night of covers.
Mm-hmm.
We've invited this particular orchestra to helm it because they have a reputation for doing interesting contemporary classical music spins on other works.
Mm-hmm.
So they were always aiming for trying to make new stuff.
And push the boundaries a bit. And I can understand how you might be flicking through your TV guide and be like, ooh, the proms do David Bowie, and expect Bowie's hits done with a beautiful big string orchestra, brass. You know, I can completely understand how you might expect that and then be disappointed.
I definitely felt like the audience in the hall were really enjoying
it. They were vibing it.
They were really loving it. And yeah, it had some fascinating stuff in it. Like John Cale performed a couple of songs. I think Lauren Vula was my favourite. She was so, so good. And really,
her voice is just amazing. I agree with you. Out of all the vocalists, she was the best. I could listen to her for hours.
Yeah, and actually, I think in general, the women singers, her, Amanda Palmer, Anna Calvi, so on, I thought did more interesting things with the songs.
Yeah.
Maybe that's because they don't feel quite the like pressure of inheritance that I think some of the male singers do.
And I think some of the male singers were chosen for the fact that they were clearly influenced by David Bowie. Yeah, Neil Hannon particularly, and the singer from Soft Cell, you can really hear it in their voices how much David Bowie was an inspiration for them. There were moments where they were talking about how much he inspired them, and I actually felt a little bit emotional. Also, the real inheritance of the night was the fact that they were doing like quite weird stuff. A lot of it was very dark, I felt like. A lot of the recompositions emphasized the sort of spookiness of a lot of David Bowie's songs, and the futurism of a lot of his songs, rather than the sort of catchiness, the rock and roll element.
Yes, I think that's true. I was actually surprised to find that I enjoyed the trio of songs they did from the most recent album, the last album, the most. Particularly Black Star, which Amanda Palmer duetted with Anna Calvi.
They were lovely together.
That was absolutely amazing. I would like buy that cover instantly because I thought it was fantastic.
It was great. And they really explored it in its length as well. They didn't, you know, reduce it at all, which was great. One of my favourite moments was Amanda Palmer doing Heroes, just because I think Heroes is such an emotional song for me that you can... Could have been anyone doing it almost. I mean, Amanda Palmer's got a really strong voice, so she carried it well. But I was waiting for it. And when it came, I was just like, oh God, this song is just so great.
Yeah, it was such an interesting mix of musicians as well, because the Stargaze Orchestra is an unusual, like it's not a conventional orchestra setup. They have...
There's not very many of them.
There's maybe like 15 of them all together. Lots of them play multiple instruments. They, you know, they play the flute, but they'll also play like the bass flute and the piccolo or the...
There was some shit up there I'd never seen.
The clarinet and a bass clarinet, which is not a very common instrument in orchestra, even for really big scale symphony stuff. And then like the conductor, sometimes he was playing the piano, sometimes he was playing the violin. Sometimes people were singing who then at other times were playing instruments. Very versatile group, and obviously not afraid to like shake it up for every single song.
I thought they were amazing. I was so impressed. And it was so daring, everything they were doing.
Yeah, and they had some electronic sounds in there as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and ditto the soloists. Some of them, they didn't sing in the way that you're necessarily accustomed to.
Mm-hmm.
They did what they thought the new version of the song should do. And they'd commissioned some really interesting young British composers to work on arrangements.
Anna Meacham was in there, who has an album that I really enjoy that is sort of electronic and quite dark and quite scary sometimes. She was great. It's nice to see people like that being used for something like this.
Yeah, and also the fact that they were crediting the arrangers and composers before each song, mm-hmm. basically suggesting that they were as instrumental in the transformation of the songs as the people performing them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so overall, I thought it was a fascinating night of music.
So did I.
Kind of what the proms, and particularly the late night proms, are always meant to be. You know, at the 7:30 proms every night, they generally have a big visiting orchestra or choir, and they play a mixture of like famous stuff from the like centuries of classical repertoire, and then also the BBC does a lot of commissioning new compositions for the prom. And then the late night proms were an innovation, I feel, not more than 10 years ago, where they normally start at 10:15, and they generally don't get such a big audience. They're shorter, they're normally about an hour, hour and a half, and it's where they do stuff that they probably couldn't sell a whole 7:30 concert of, and that ranges from like early Renaissance music that has a smaller pool of fans to stuff like David Bowie. Last year they had a grime prom that they did jointly with Six Music that was, I think, a not dissimilar thing. So yeah, I really thought it was a good innovation.
Yeah, same. You know, if you're watching it on iPlayer, just have those caveats in mind and you'll probably really enjoy it.
Yeah.
Like the dolphins, like dolphins can swim, and nothing will keep us together. Oh, we can beat them forever and ever. We can be heroes just for one day.
So last week, Caroline was going to introduce herself to the work of Heather Havrileski, an agony aunt for New York Magazine and elsewhere, who has a book out at the moment called How to Be a Person in the World. Caroline, did you do that?
I did indeed. I read back through the last 2 or 3 months worth, actually, of Ask Polly columns. And it's so interesting because obviously each week she's dealing with a particular question posed to her by a reader.
And these aren't questions that are like, "Dear Polly, my husband's sister keeps nagging me about what to feed the children, and I don't think it's any of her business, but I also don't want to be rude to her. What should I do?" It's not these kinds of questions,
no,
is it?
They're far more existential and deep questions. Mm-hmm. You know, there was one that I read that was like, "Why am I always too much for men?"
That's a good one, I remember.
Which is really good. They range from stuff about romantic life to friendship to professional life, and they're mostly from women. Mm-hmm. And it's a very safe space, women reading area, felt like.
Definitely.
And having read, about 12 or 13 of them, I think some trends kind of emerge in her approach to all of these problems.
Yes, do tell.
I think the biggest one is about self-reliance. A lot of the time when people write in, they say, you know, I've always really wanted to, you know, pursue my writing, but I feel all this pressure from family and society to like have this job I hate and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And her answer is always, yeah, it's really difficult to want to do something that isn't going to make you so much money. But if the answer to will it make you happy is yes, then you must do it. You know, so it's all about finding out exactly what it is you want as an individual and then doing it and politely disregarding anyone who disagrees with that.
Yeah. That is definitely a trend.
I think related to that as well, this kind of idea of self-reliance and individual expression, she has a really strong line in advising about self-care.
Yeah.
Which I feel is a phrase that I've seen more and more bandied about on the internet in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. And it really just refers to consulting your own wishes, not being selfish, not to the detriment of other people necessarily, but not putting yourself through either physical or mental hardship because you think it's what other people want.
Yeah, you know, Tarvi Gevinson at Rookie has referred to this in some of her editor's letters as being your own mother.
Yeah.
And like caring for yourself in the way that you might care for like a vulnerable person in your life.
On the newsletter that the Another Round podcast does, there's a really good section heading where it's called like the self-care section, and the subheading is drink some water, take your meds, call your mom, go outside. As those are like four steps to feeling better about whatever it is that's making you feel not good.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the vibe, is, you know, don't overlook the simple things that will make your life easier in the long term. So if that happens to be staying in bed today, then you should do it. Mm-hmm. Or if it's just making a really simple change to your routine where you walk a bit further because it will make you feel better, you should do it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get those things in place, then other bigger, more existential problems, Heather suggests, will start to seem a lot less big and scary too.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's pretty good advice generally.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's kind of what I gathered from reading them, is that she has this underlying life philosophy that you tap into, but she personalizes it for each question that she gets. And obviously she includes specific examples from her own life or from the world to try and help the person who's writing in. And I think that's partly why I liked it so much, is because some agony aunts are too specific. Because there's no wider thing you can extrapolate from it. It's all like, you should get your husband to do this specific thing and then it will be easier. You know?
Don't care.
Or they're way too vague and wishy-washy. And I'm thinking particularly back to my teenage days of reading like 17 magazine and stuff. They were always just like, yeah, just like maybe slow down a bit and things will seem easier.
Follow your heart.
Oh, God.
When they've written in being like, my heart is contradicting itself.
Yes. So what Ask Polly gives you is a really good blend of, here is how to solve this specific problem, but also informed by the tenets of her own like continuous philosophy, from
exactly.
which you can take and interpret what you want.
So, a fan?
Yeah, definitely. I really want to get hold of this book as well.
I'll lend it to you.
Excellent.
So, yeah, do you have, check out her columns, guys, and her book too. So, Caroline, what about for me next week?
So, for next week, I am going to recommend you a film that I just saw, actually, and I'm still thinking about, which is the film 8½, directed by famous Italian director Fellini.
Ooh, we're getting highbrow.
Yeah, so we're going super highbrow. So this is a film from 1963, from kind of the, I guess you'd say, like the peak of Italian cinema. It's definitely up there with what are considered the greats, I suppose. It's one of those like films about making a film. Its central character is a film director who's got massive creative block, really. He is way, way behind on delivering a script and a treatment for a film that is sort of already being made around him, even though he hasn't told anybody what it's about. So he's got all of these actors being like, what's my part? What's my part? They're already on the set which makes no sense whatsoever because he hasn't told anyone what it should be. He's got a producer working round the clock at doing God knows what because he hasn't told anyone what they're supposed to be doing. And in the middle of all this, he is having a kind of existential man crisis where he's like having an affair with one woman but also really happy with his wife. And intermingled with all of this, he is having these intense flashbacks to his childhood where he, you know, grew up going to a very Catholic like seminary type school, and all the various ways that he tried to transgress and was then punished and all this kind of thing. So this all gets like stirred together in this kind of inexplicable mess, you might say. Although it is also, you can just tell when you're watching it that I don't really understand this, but it's definitely a masterpiece.
Okay, cool. I'm intrigued. Can't wait to find out more. Thanks for listening to Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to Seriously. All you have to do is search SRSLY in iTunes or any other podcasting app you use. While you're there, it would be really great if you could leave us an iTunes review, as it helps other people find the show.
We also rely on you listeners for your recommendations. So if you want to tell us what you thought about something, or if you've got something we should watch, you can contact us on Twitter, Facebook, via email. All the details are on seriouslypodcast.com. If you like, you can also recommend us to your friends, family, neighbours, strangers. Let them know that you like the podcast and that they should be listening to it too.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.